Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We hear about global warming every single day. And warming is not warm and fuzzy. Where's the David to slay the global Goliath? Many are pointing to a cap-and-trade marketplace. What's that going to look like? And how's it all work? We continue to explore the many facets of the global CO2 cap-and-trade future when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We continue now to deepen our understanding of carbon cap and trade. We're talking with Josh Margolis, who's the Managing Director of Cantor Fitzgerald. And Josh, we need to be able to visualize how this works. And we've talked about the fact that, for example, California now, Governor Schwarzenegger, has really made a commitment to deal with greenhouse gas levels and setting up systems to deal with this, and primarily with carbon caps and enforcement. Now I want to figure out, and I'm sure you can help us out here, how do we see this happening? In other words, so the state has made this decision. Who participates? Are they able to, for example, to say, well, we're going to assign these credits to industries, to sectors, to corporations, to specific corporations, to those people who would be the major contributors to conceivably carbon dioxide in our environment? And then let's start with that. Do you have a concept on how that's done, how that may be done in California, for example?
The world in 7 days. I mean, those are excellent questions. The governor did both the hard and the easy thing. He said the debate is over. We have a problem. We're going to fix it, and we're going to reduce our emissions by 200 million tons by the year 2020. And then had an executive order that says beyond that, we're going to reduce our emissions by a total of 90% by the year 2050. So that's a very hard thing to say because it takes a leap of faith. But it's also, the guy who's got the most difficult job is Chuck Schulock at the California Resources Board. He's the one that's tasked with managing a process that's going to define who's in the program, whether it's a command and control or a market-based program, which sectors are in the program, when the reductions have to begin, whether or not there are annual reduction requirements or whether it's just one grand reduction requirement by the year 2020, what the enforcement consequences are, whether or not reductions from other states can be used. There are a host of issues, whether it's an upstream or a downstream program.
It's no wonder I'm having a difficult time, as well as everybody else, understanding this.
The folks who understand how significant this program is will be to California are the ones who understand that it's going to affect them, their businesses, their competition. Folks in every sector of the economy are going to be affected by this program in ways that they can't fathom or imagine at this point. They will be going through a conversion, and it's up to the folks in Sacramento and the business and the Chamber of Commerce and the trade associations to proselytize and to help them understand that it's a new world. The guys on the beach who are looking at the waves coming in, who see the ripple, you know, some of them understand that it's a tsunami that is is going to wash through the economy. Some of them are taking pictures. Mm-hmm. Some of them are saying it can't have much of an effect because it's not so big right now. Some of them are lying down in the sun. Others have started to run. And others are going for high ground, and they're trying to figure out what their opportunities are, and they're taking steps now. Mm-hmm. The folks who are going to win are the ones who understand how significant this program is, what's at stake, and what decisions have to be made. The ones who win will be the ones who participate in the policymaking process, who advocate whether or not to auction or allocate emissions, whether or not it's going to be a command and control program or a permit or a market-based program. Mm-hmm. The ones who participate in these discussions, who make their voices heard, will have their voices heard in the policymaking debates, and that those policymaking debates are ongoing right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say I'm looking at some models. I'd like to envision some models. One could be, for example, if this was my job, I might say, well, let's start somewhere. Let's one of the corporate sectors that we can really focus on are energy companies, because they add a lot directly. We can see it coming out of their smokestacks all over California, and there's a lot of them. There's a whole lot of them, and they're adding a lot to our greenhouse gases. What if we started with them? I'm just trying to get a sense of how this might develop.
Well, you could limit the program just to the power sector.
Right, you could. You could say that's where we're going to start.
Mm-hmm. But okay. If you did that, you'd be missing most of the problem. Most of the problem comes from the transportation sector.
Well, this is where we get into these. And then how in the world would you begin to, let's just brainstorm here, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. But hey, I got a car. How am I going to play in this game? Or how are these regulations going to affect me? Let's just talk about that. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, if I'm a policymaker, I want to affect change. I want people's behavior to change. I want them to use less fuel, to drive fewer miles, to make changes in their lives that will reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. I can do that by tapping into their own incentives that they respond to. I can make gasoline more expensive. I can put on congestion use charges on toll roads, on highways. I can make it expensive to park at work. I can reward people for taking steps that reduce the vehicle miles traveled, both in terms of reducing fees and costs, and I can provide them with free parking, right? Or I can go upstream. I can affect the people who sell the fuels, who run the toll roads, who distribute the fuels in pipelines. I can go all the way up to the people who bring in the fuels across state borders, and I can to levy a fee or a tax of sorts on what they do and the products that they sell in the state. Now, taxes in California, you may have heard, are not very popular. And a politician doesn't stand much of a chance if he advocates, frankly, a carbon tax. So what do you do?
Yeah.
You can mandate specific control measures, or you can offer people a declining emissions budget. You can say you can operate in the state of California, you can live in the state of California, you can use fuels, you can distribute fuels so long as you stay within the emissions allocation that I'm giving you.
In essence, that would put a real limit in terms of how much a person could participate in the game, how much they could sell, for example, once they reach that. Am I right about that? That it might put a limit on what they can market, how much they can market.
Yeah, I mean, every activity has a carbon footprint. And the smart policymaker is going to figure out a way to incentivize folks to reduce the size of that carbon footprint and disincentivize the folks who take no steps to reduce it, in fact, folks who put more carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly a limit on you if you do nothing. If you do nothing to change your footprint, if you do nothing to change the carbon intensity of your manufacturing operations.
Good point, yeah.
It certainly is a limit. But it is no limit for those who can figure out how to operate within their carbon budget, and people have expanded gloriously in other cap-and-trade programs.
That becomes the aha, that's the incentive. Okay, if I want to expand the capacity for me to market a particular product because of the caps, what I need to do now is to figure out ways to reduce that footprint, and then I can sell more.
Reduce the footprint, and so you can sell more chairs, gasoline, houses, cars, glass windows. Any product that's made in the state of California mm-hmm. has a carbon footprint. The manufacturer, the distributor, the reseller will likely be drawn into this program. Will be provided an opportunity to participate in this cap and trade program, if in fact that's the way it goes.
Well, now, from my perspective, this would be to some extent an administrative nightmare, in the sense that thousands and thousands of people are going to have to go around and literally make determinations about what that carbon footprint is. How is that handled? How's that going to? What are people talking about in terms of how that would actually happen?
Well, it could be a nightmare, or it could be very elegantly simple.
Oh, there we go.
Your challenge as a policymaker is to figure out why people do things. They do things because they have an opportunity to make money, to save money, to provide for the security of their family, to meet the mandates of the corporate CEO. So all you need to do is to figure out why people do things and how to torque the programs in order to accomplish those ends. Now, of course, there are many, many different ways to verify and to determine whether or not the goals are being met. But at the end of the day, you as an individual, as a corporation, as a trade association, will have a declining emissions checkbook. You're going to be responsible for reporting what your emissions are. And either you're going to be compliant because you've kept your emissions within that allocation, or you won't. And if you're not, you're going to suffer the consequence. Who's included in the trading program? That's up to the policymakers. Will you be included as an individual? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Will your school be included? There's a good chance it will.
Mm-hmm.
Will it be the school district? It's a good chance. Will it be the school bus, the folks who manufacture and sell the school buses? There's a good chance.
You know, the model that we're really talking about very often are what are referred to as carbon credits. In other words, that various businesses, whatever that designation is, will receive so many credits that they can then begin to exchange. The good guys can sell theirs to the bad guys, so to speak. And in that process, be rewarded for having a smaller footprint. But now I want to talk about
let me interrupt you there.
Yeah,
not
sure.
So much the good guys and the bad guys. It's the guys who have an opportunity to reduce their emissions at a lower cost. Those are the ones that should attract the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I spend $10 to accomplish a pound of carbon reductions when I can do it for $1?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And is the guy for whom it's going to cost $10 a bad guy? No, he's not a bad guy. He's the one that is faced with a compliance control cost curve that's far steeper than somebody else. And we as a society, we should want the most efficient use of our money. We should spend only the minimum amount of money to come up with the needed reductions and use the rest of the money for other needs.
One of the things that I hear people talking about, and I've been approached in different situations, is that I, as an individual, in an almost an act of consciousness, but it does have real consequence, can in essence, we're almost having to become a little bit politically correct here, but that I can literally buy off my guilt. I as a household, I have a house, I have a car, I've got a couple of cars here. I try to be efficient, and I'm also concerned that I can actually participate in buying credits and therefore, in essence, eliminate my carbon footprint from this concept of the limits, the cap. Okay, can you help people understand that concept, because people are talking about that?
Sure, and it's, I guess I go back to the first Earth Day when I was walking down the street picking up trash. I didn't do that out of guilt. I did that following my father's example as a way to do what was the responsible thing to do, to take care of my own footprints, to take care of my own society, to offset my own impact and that of my neighbors. That's a responsible thing to do. And customers who buy products, whether it's an airline seat or a hotel room or a car, or who buy power from the grid, they look at this global warming problem, and oftentimes they're paralyzed by it. You know, they know, they have a sense that it's real. They have a sense that it needs to be addressed. They have a sense that that the consequence of not addressing it is pretty significant. But what can they do as an individual? How can they affect change? Well, it's up to the corporate world who sells products to these individuals. It's up to the folks who sell the airline seats, to sell the cars, the hotel rooms, the opportunities to park in a garage. It's up to them to figure out how an individual can participate. Well, one way to do it is to calculate what the impact is of parking in a garage, of buying a car, of driving into the city, of driving to the mountains, of skiing in Squaw Creek. To calculate the cost of doing that, both in terms of carbon as well as the cost of reducing that carbon emissions, and saying to me, the consumer, would you like to participate in solving the problem? Well, sure I would. Nobody's ever offered me the chance to do that before. How much will it cost, by the way? Oh, you know, for this particular flight across country, it'll cost you $6. To offset your carbon footprint. $6? That's not so bad. I just spent $650 to fly across country to a round trip. Add another $6 to it? I can do that. Yeah, would that make me feel good? Sure it would, because I'm doing the right thing.
Now, the question that I think a lot of people would ask at a certain point is, and I think rightfully so, because this is just the way the brain works, you know. Wait a second, I just gave somebody $6. what did I give them $6 for? What are they going to do with that $6, and how is that going to somehow end up solving the problem?
Excellent question. The power is not in your individual action, but you're just like everybody, just like everybody else in that plane. Everybody else who's in on the sixth floor of the Sheraton Hotel that you're staying in, just like everybody else who's driving across the Golden Gate Bridge or who's skiing that day in Squaw Creek. Those who have decided to participate, they're also contributing $6. That $6 times 1,000 people can turn into $6,000, which can then buy a good quantity of carbon reductions once aggregated together. So the power is in the numbers, the folks who are of like minds, who individually act in a collective way, whose monies and resources then can be targeted towards projects, carbon reduction projects aimed at schools, changing out light bulbs, carbon reduction projects aimed at changing out old hot water heaters, making them more efficient, changing out school buses to make them use less fuel, changing out the power loss associated with industrial boilers.
I follow your thinking here. The 1,000 people who paid the $6 to, we'll say it's a company, that there was a company that was able to market to 1,000 people a $6 carbon credit.
Let's go back here. It's not sure. $6 per credit. It's $6 to accomplish, to buy off the reductions, to pay for sufficient reductions to offset your footprint.
What does that company, okay, then let's go to that company that now has the money. How do they then play in the marketplace such that it ultimately ends up in something real?
Well, those monies go to specific projects, whether it's in the community or in a neighboring community or somewhere else in the state of California or in the Kalahari Desert where they're using solar ovens as opposed to burning biomass fuel.
So would this be in the form of investment?
It's money that's then turned around and plowed back into projects that need the money in order to accomplish greenhouse gas reductions on site locally where those projects.
And I'm really just trying to understand this. Would this be in the form of a grant or a gift or there's kind of three ways to do it: a grant, a loan, or investment. Which one? Where are we going with those in terms of how that money that they would have would then become distributed to these projects?
Yes. It's used in all three ways and other ways. It's up to the market to come up with the most cost-effective solution. Remember, behind the scenes, we have a bunch of air quality entrepreneurs. They're all competing with each other to use those monies to come up with cost-effective, quality ways of reducing carbon. And it's the ones who have the best solutions, the most cost-effective solutions, the ones that are going to deliver the best carbon that will win those monies. And is it somebody who's deciding? Is it a commission or a foundation that decides who gets the money? In the long run, it's the market that decides it. It's the forces of supply and demand.
Well, that's very interesting. So it really is a free-form market. I guess the thing that I think some people get confused about, and I realize, you know, actually, quite honestly, what we're talking about here is many different visions of how this will happen. So there is no one answer. No one can be expected to have one answer to this.
There are some in Sacramento and in Washington who believe they do have the answer, and they're going to do their level best to have their answer be that which emerges from the other end of the policymaking black box.
Right. But until such time, then it's much more on an individual basis and on a smaller scale.
Right now, there is no mandate.
Right.
In California, we don't have a mandate to offset your carbon when you go skiing, when you drive your car, when you stay in a hotel, when you take a flight. There is no mandate.
Mm-hmm.
The mandates will be emerging from a policymaking process, and a program will commence starting sometime before 2012.
Now I want to focus this in one little area. Let's say, for example, now that we've moved along and the state has decided to focus on just power companies. Let's just say it was that. Okay, because this will help people understand how this could work. So they've decided that power companies contribute so much to greenhouse gases, and they've decided now to distribute credits, a certain number of credits to each power company per, let's say, 1,000 megawatts of production. You get so many credits. Now, one company is a cleaner company, and the carbon footprint that they put out is much less than another company that perhaps is using coal or some other less clean source of energy. In order for them to comply, they're going to have to buy some credits from a cleaner company. That's where this market happens. Any concept of how those companies, one company that perhaps is green, perhaps they're a solar company, they therefore have credits that they can sell, and then there's another company that's old coal and polluting, and they need to buy these credits. Let's talk about that exchange. How do they talk to each other? How do they do business? How do they exchange those credits?
Well, in the state of California, actually, if you're generating power, you're required now to generate power in as if you're using the cleanest fuels available. If you're importing power from out of the state, you have to apply the same standards. So already these folks are faced with a need under SB 1368, the Parada bill, to generate power using clean fuels. They're also required to they're subject to a renewable portfolio standard where they have to have a certain percentage of the power generated from renewable energy, which is generally thought of as having a lower greenhouse gas footprint than through fossil fuels. But let's assume that beyond that, that I'm allocated, I'm given 10,000 tons of carbon allowances, and my business as usual strategy requires me to put out 15,000 tons.
Right.
So I've got a 5,000 ton deficit. What do I do? I've got a couple of choices. I don't have to buy from you. I can solve my problems myself. It's within my power to generate enough electricity to serve my customers and to stay within my 10,000 ton limit. How can I do that? Well, I can do that by changing the fuel mix, by buying more renewables, by generating more power from renewables, which has the effect of generating more power in a way that produces less carbon. I can switch. I can buy power from somebody else and stop generating myself. And that if I generate power through the use of natural gas, and I can stop doing that for one unit, and I can buy solar generated power from somebody else, and I can support their project, right? Or I can buy allowances from somebody else, okay? Carbon allowances, and those carbon allowances I can buy from another utility or somebody else who has decided that they wanted to participate in that market. And whether it's a utility-only market or a multi-sectoral market, I should have expect to see folks who have permits and carbon-generating activities in the state, as well as who are participants and who are speculators who provide liquidity to the market.
But those credits, therefore, have a certain value, and that value is fluctuating. It is a market. It's like a commodity. Am I correct about that?
The value does fluctuate, yes.
Right, exactly. And so, for example, a person could an individual buy some of those credits, for example?
Sure, an individual could buy it. An environmental group could buy it. A school district could buy it. The third grade class could buy it. A foundation could buy it. The California Pension Trust could buy it. A Wall Street company could buy it. Mm-hmm. Anybody could participate.
People can actually participate in those exchanges and actually affect what's happening in terms of this dynamic between some of these big power companies.
And that's the beauty of what California is doing. California has said we're going to, without regard to what Washington is doing, this is the program. It's going to affect California industries. Now, we have the ability to affect change elsewhere. How do we do that? Well, we can do that by allowing in emission reductions, the offsets, if you will, that are generated in Nevada or Rhode Island or Uganda or some other geographic area outside of California, mm-hmm. so long as they meet our criteria.
Mm-hmm.
So California can say, okay, you can accomplish a reduction in New Jersey, but it has to be according to our criteria. So they have control now. They have effective control over emissions-generating activities that are going on across the country. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Isn't that a good thing?
Well, it's so interesting because this ultimately leads to what, for example, Kyoto was trying to accomplish, and that is a global market, a global cap, a global means to regulate and therefore control and diminish the pollutants in our air, the greenhouse gases. So it's beginning. It's actually beginning.
It's beginning, and it's driven first by the people who are work for CEOs or light CEOs who, are, for whatever reason, have decided that it's time to change their formula to reduce the emissions of carbon, and they may be doing it because of an altruistic need, because it's a grandfather looking out for his grandchildren, because it's a CEO who is expecting to see carbon control requirements on the horizon, who has been told by his insurance carrier that he's got to reduce his exposure to the carbon related events that could come about associated with future weather, and what can he do individually to affect those events. Or because shareholders are expected to voice their concerns about how the company is managing its carbon footprint, and with the understanding that if they fail to manage it appropriately, if they don't manage it, that the shareholders will then suffer. Or it's coming about as a result of the state of California, who said that you will be expected to participate in a carbon control program.
I think this would be the thought pattern for quite a number of people that I'm aware of, where they might say something like this. They might say, well, okay, great. So we're supposed to do this, but some little country in Africa or perhaps some burg of Russia that doesn't want to play in this game could pollute, not play in the game, and screw it all up, and it's all kind of a meaningless effort, because if they're not part of this economic cap system, they kind of mess up the game, don't they?
Well, you I guess you're left at the end of the day with your own decisions that you need to make, and you can make those decisions because you believe they're right, or you can make the decisions based upon what you think you can get away with. And if you're able to walk away from a mess that you've made and say, I'm not going to clean it up until somebody else cleans up their mess overseas, then are you really doing the responsible thing? If you know that failing to address the problem today is going to exacerbate the problem, so that when ultimately you're forced to address it in the future, when the world has finally got a consensus, that the costs have been passed on down to future generations, and that your children's children are going to both suffer the consequences of your inactivity as well as the cost of addressing it because you've delayed it, do you really feel good about that? It gets back to what my dad said. Why not me? Why shouldn't I act?
Josh Margolis, I want to just say, I got a great big smile on my face. It is so refreshing to hear someone from what we would call the corporate and finance world talking with such a high sense of idealism. Because I'm asking some tough questions, and you're really coming back to some very profound guidance. It's up to each of us now to take a stand to do the right thing.
It's up to each of us, but also to demand that the others in our community, the folks that we buy products from, to give us an opportunity to participate.
Mm-hmm.
I want to buy your product. I'd like to keep on buying it. I like what you do. Let me participate. Let me make a difference. Because I will. If you let me, I will.
Help me help you help everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you so much, Josh. First of all, it has really helped me to understand, and I'm sure many other people, about the carbon cap and trade system. And you're going to be up in San Francisco March 5th and 6th at the 2007 Carbon Cap and Trade Forum. We'll inform people on how they can participate in that. If they want to learn more about Cantor Fitzgerald and your work and how you guys are working in this field, how should they do that?
Give us a browse at www.emissionstrading.com, emissionstrading.com, or at co2e.com, their sister company, or give us a call, 800-228-2955.
Josh Margolis, Managing Director of Cantor Fitzgerald, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. It was a pleasure.
That's a broad and open-ended discussion of the cap-and-trade future. Next, we go where the future is now, to Oregon, where a cap-and-trade system is up and running. Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.